Welcome to the Attitat Show, where we keep it real and never shy away from the tough questions. Today we've got Jeff Hirsch from Aperium Ventures, an ad tech maestro who's been rocking the digital world since the days of dial-up. Jeff, what's up? Are you soaring like a superhero or just trying to keep the villains at bay? We're diving into Jeff's epic journey from the prehistoric era of value click to today's cutting-edge chaos. No fluff, no nonsense, just pure, unfiltered insights. Get ready for a wild ride. Let's get this show on the road.
Deserve to win when it matters most. Facing multi-billion dollar bet the company litigation? No problem. That's why we're here. Troutman Amin, LLP, is a true legal
powerhouse.
Welcome
to the Adotis Show, where the pixels meet the people and the click-throughs count, but the points don't matter. Today, we're dialing in the man who's been lighting up the ad tech skyline brighter than a billboard in Times Square, Jeff Hirsch of Aperium Ventures. Strap in, adjust your reality goggles, and maybe double shot that espresso, because we're about to take a wild ride through the electric veins of the ad tech world with a guy who knows its secrets better than anyone. Jeff, how's the digital domain treating you lately? Are we talking superhero status or just surviving the villain's lair?
I've always thought it's a combination of both. I often joke about I've been doing in ad tech really since 1996, and I'm just about ready to get it figured out.
Let's roll the tape back. When does the legend of Jeff Hirsch begin? Were you coded by ancient gods, or did you hack your way out of the Matrix?
Besides my time with Al Gore forming the internet, I'm just joking about that. This is really my third career. I was in advertising, media, print, radio, and agency early in my career. Then I had a software company for about 8 years on the Inc. 500 list. And then found the internet. In 1996, I wrote a business plan called AdClick, which was a precursor to ad networks. At the time, I was not savvy enough to be able to raise money. I did sign up some publishers in 96, but it was a bit too early. I did use that business plan to go into value click, meet with the founder, Brian Coriat, started in Santa Barbara, which is luckily where I lived, and that was the beginning of things.
So in your saga, what's been the Herculean task? One trial that you had wondering you bitten off more than you could chew?
Well, I don't know about more than I can chew, because we usually accomplish anything I set out to do. But I will say it on InScience. First of all, we were one of the first companies to really use data to drive digital advertising. InScience, we called Revenue Science before, was working as a DFP for publishers. And when I came on board, the mandate was to use data in a privacy appropriate way, and all data permission to be used to build an advertising network. So we built the first advertising network using audience data, and quickly became, within 2 years, the fifth largest ad network in the U.S. So all that was going great and continued to go well. And we then took that same technology and leveraged it to use it for advertisers. And that was the beginning of the work we did with P&G to create Hawkeye Programs, which was P&G's effort and global for Audience Science to be the DSP and DMP for them, and create a holistic solution around the globe. So getting to your answer, one of the issues was when I joined Audience Science, they had already raised significant money, and the ability to raise money, frankly, when I went to talk to the potential partners, the comment I most often received was, this is the most convoluted cap table we've ever seen. We have no idea how to even be involved. And so we weren't able to raise additional money, and that left our scientists in a position where it was very difficult to scale beyond the one single largest client and to do some of the things that we had hoped to do on our mission.
So walking into ValueClick was akin to stepping into a nascent battlefield armed with nothing but a slingshot and a dream. In those early days of digital pioneering, what was the alchemy behind turning clicks into gold? Divine inspiration? Or did you have the Midas touch from the get-go?
I think what was really happening then, and where we saw a lot of the problems with the digital economy at the time, was that buying clicks and ValueClick did very well, as did advertising.com, which was ThickoSurf at the time.
Right.
Was really to drive traffic to websites to support their effort to go public. It wasn't so much, I mean, there were certainly performance advertisers that we did an excellent job for. Kaysak, you were one of them back in the fast click days. But in the value click days, it was really just about traffic driving, not so much about conversion, which of course a click is fantastic for. But there's no, you know, long term value. It was interesting back in those days. It was such a nascent time. I had a club dev team that were people from, I hired in from a outbound marketing company. We had stacks of books with website names and owners, and they were just calling up saying, did you know you can make money by running ads on your site? And they had no clue. And then we were offering them 19, 20, 21 cents a click. And then TechnoSurf was competing and you go back and forth to make a cost per click acquisition, your supply side deal. And we were then turn around and selling at 50 cents plus on the CPC side. So it was an interesting time back then. People thought CTR was really what the measurement criteria would be from that point forward. So it was so much learning, so much to be able to do.
So FastClick wasn't just the name, it was a mission statement for you. As you revved up this engine, what were the speed bumps you hit and how did you determine to launch pads? Was it a smooth ride in the stratosphere or did you have to navigate through some asteroid fields?
Well, I'd say it was asteroid fields. So when we were originally intending to launch FastClick, it was because, again, FastClick was another Santa Barbara company. The joke for me, right, of course, that any Santa Barbara company with the name Click in it, I was at. So that included ValueClick, FastClick, and ExpertClick, which was free for.
But I heard you had a beautiful view. I remember.
Of course, we did.
I remember Barb always telling me that she had this view of Santa Barbara, and she was quite jetted view, I think, at the time of a street in New York somewhere.
It's such a magical place to live in, right? I will get back there. Anything with the word click in it, I was there. So ExpertClick was also a company that was a precursor to AdECN, and where Jeff Green really got started on his journey. So at the time we were building FastClick, we were going to, it was actually started by a few aerospace engineers out of UC Santa Barbara, and they saw that ValueClick was directed to me to do this better. We can do it faster, hence the name FastClick. But by the time we got to market, the market had crashed. So CPC was not going to be an effective model. And it forced us, and thankfully one of the founders was a brilliant engineer, Jeff Fryer, and he was able to develop algorithms that allowed us to take in a CPA buy, cost per acquisition or action or lead, and convert that automatically to an effective CPM that we could confidently pay out to the publisher. So we were able to work with advertisers the way they wanted to work, which was pay for performance, especially then, and publishers the way that they wanted to work, which was pay me a CPM and I only know how much I'm making. So it was a big hurdle, and overcoming it actually gave us the magic to build a company that eventually also led public.
So reflecting on your times at ValueClick and FastClick, what were the bedrock principles you unearthed? Were they born from triumphs, trenches, or a bit of both?
It was all just experiment, learn, and grow, right? So first of all, the CPA campaigns that we were running, we found that at things like if you change anything, like if you pause it for a day and restarted it, it wouldn't perform the same as it had done 2 days ago. So why is that happening? How can we do better with that? Should we have multiple CPA campaigns running at the same time at different arbitrage machine behind it so that we could maximize the value that we were getting? Everything was an experiment and then a quick reaction. Originally, we were only doing 468 banners. Then we introduced 728. And then we came up with the brilliant idea to do medium rectangles. So that's how early it was, and that's how interesting it was to keep learning. The big winner for ValueClick at the time, as it was for companies like Undercom and others, was with Paul Unders, which, of course, are not really in vogue now, but were a wonderful way to launch an ad behind a browser and create substantial performance.
Do you think banners and display will ever come back, or you think it's just auxiliary to video now?
Look, I think that this is one thing that I heard someone mention on one of her previous podcasts, but a lot of the people in an ad tech did not come out of the advertising world. They probably an ad tech or came from a technology point of view or data point of view. And all that's great and gets us to a lot of innovation. But if you come from an advertising world, you understand that every advertiser is going to use multiple means to reach the consumer. So I don't think display will ever die. In fact, in some cases, it's pretty healthy, but it's only one piece of the puzzle. And I think that's also why the opportunity digital at home. I mean, look, backing that up, there are still printed yellow pages that we get, right? So marketing for a company is using any channel that you can cost effectively get to the consumer and put in a message. And some of that may be affected by what your brand is and available format and all of that. But so in general, I think they'll always hear us.
So stepping into PubMatic was like catching a tiger by the tail. As you morph from chief marketing officer, chief commercial officer, accumulating in that IPO high wire act, was it more of a circus juggling or wizardry? And did you wear a cape or a crash helmet?
I love all your analogies. Thank you for that. When I joined PubMatic, it was a time when many of the ad networks were recognizing what was possible for an SSP, right? So we saw Rubicon starting to change, eventually becoming Magnite. We saw Consulting Media starting to change, becoming Index. And PubMatic was the same without changing its name. They were originally more of an ad network, and the opportunity was there to become a true supply-side platform that would support the needs of the publishers and thereby have the inventory to sell to marketers. So it was very exciting to join at that time. One of the first things we did was change how we presented ourselves as a company. Most companies at that time, when you went to their website, there was an advertiser section and a publisher section. So that immediately had that connotation of an ad. We took a page out of Oracle and Salesforce, Joanna Bauman, who was still the CMO at PubMatic. And I took a page from Salesforce and Oracle, redesigned how we were presenting ourselves to the market as a software and technology company, because that really is truly what PubMatic is. And a lot of the SSPs are. So it was a great time to have the chance to create the basis for what is now the modern SSP. And it was very fun to be on that journey. And of course, with that, gain the opportunity to grow at a pace and bring on the kinds of publishers and advertisers that we did to be able to go public during the pandemic, by the way, which was quite interesting.
So I want to talk a little bit about the evolution of ad tech from an insider's perspective. In the high stakes poker game of ad tech, where a single card can flip fortunes, tell me, Jeff, about the hand you didn't expect. How did it change your strategy, and what was the outcome? And tell me it led to a royal flush and not a fold.
Well, I think that the experience at Audience Science probably is the best example of what you're saying, is that, again, data in digital, clearly now, not a question, but at the time, it was relatively new and how to do it and being able to leverage the same technology to address publishers and ad network and advertisers was a great experience. And it taught me a lot about how to be efficient and effective in your growth planning. Now, I'll say we somewhat stumbled upon that, but it gave me the learnings necessary to be able to have a much more forward-looking a few of it to do at a company strategically, and I find myself applying that regularly now.
So during, so who has been the Obi-Wan to your Luke Skywalker guiding you through the ad tech galaxy? And did they come with a lightsaber, or was it more of use the force, Jeff?
Well, I would say from a business perspective, I really don't have someone like that. I probably think of myself as that. I'm not trying to be egotistically, but my early coming in early and developing new technologies and always being on the edge of innovation meant that I had to be very forward thinking about how to do business and how to be successful. Someone who was extremely influential in helping me understand the big vision better was Basil Nafe, who was the CTO at Audience Science, who had a phenomenal vision. I mean, he really saw what all of this would come to with DSPs and SSPs and bidding and audiences. And having a partner like that there helped me see what was possible on the technology side. I now am partnered with Joe Zawoski and Emma. She also has a visionary capability that I find very unique. And it's wonderful to be around that because all it does is stimulate new ideas. It's great.
So talking a little bit about merger and acquisition, some say it's where dreams go to get a reality check. Can you recall a time that tested your mettle?
Yeah, it wasn't a very big acquisition, but it was certainly very strategic. When I was at Audium Science, there was a company called Wonderloop and Jerry. That was a DMP. I was funding work on the advertiser side. That was near bankruptcy. So two things were important there. One, it gave us an opportunity in the European market and being stronger there. And two, they had a deep relationship with P&G, who we were developing our relationship here in the U.S. with. And so we decided to make the acquisition. What I didn't know at the time are our laws, HR laws specifically in Germany. So we had two account managers and one was clearly better than the other. So we terminated the one that was not as skilled and they sued us to get their job. And the reason why they were able to win, I can't imagine wanting to do that and come back to work. The reason why they won is because they had children and the other person didn't. And I had no idea. You know, when you operate in the U.S., it's you've got the opportunity to make decisions about personnel that are more advantageous to the business than the person. So it's an interesting change of perspective when you start working in other countries.
So innovation is often a tricky beast. Sometimes it roars, sometimes it whimpers. Which tech trend did you back that turned out to be a paper tiger?
Well, I think that everything having to do with programmatic has turned out to be as powerful. I had hoped it would be. Audience Science was using Ray Media as a platform. If you listen to Ryan Hawk about the early exchanges, we were doing a lot of business with them. And that was the beginning of being able to really take advantage of programmatic. And because of that, we have been able to continue to extend over time.
With third-party cookies getting the boot, what's baking in the oven over at Perium? Do you have any new recipes for success that you're cooking up?
Well, I think we're pretty confident in some of the solutions. So Perium is by nature a fund, a VC company, and an untold number of companies in their portfolios. And some of those are ID companies, and because of that, we're very vested in what happens there. I'm very confident in our ability to make adaptations as we go continue to move forward. What I'm doing now for Perium is I'm getting up in partnership with Ofer Alzheimer, our advisory and activation program, which basically with the group of people we have, an extended network of friends and OGs, we're able to bring to the market some very insightful consulting services to help companies understand where they're placed in the market, look at new product launches, bring solutions from the international to the U.S., and a lot of different things like that.
So steering a company to IPO is like directing a blockbuster. What director's commentary can you share for the startups dreaming of their name and lights? Is it lights, camera, action, or wait, where's my script?
Look, the truth of the matter is an IPO is really a funding event. Obviously, it does create liquidity for employees, and that's why it's oftentimes an important thing to hope for. But the most important thing about being able to go public is the same as it is about anything else in the business, getting acquired or whatever else it might be, is you have to build a strong company. You have to pay attention to the bottom line. You cannot just grow for growth's sake, and you have to do so with rigorous processes that people follow. If you do all those things, you're going to build a successful company, and with that, you will end up having choices. One of those could be an IPO, given that your growth and your EBITDA is strong enough, and the markets are ready for that.
Are there any companies you didn't take to an IPO that you wish had been?
Well, again, going back to Audio Science, I think that had the potential to be a winner in that regard. Otherwise, I'm pretty happy with where things have ended up.
Looking to the future, as you look over the ad tech horizon, what are large changes you see brewing, and how is Perium preparing to ride the shockwave?
That's a Good question. What we're seeing is that enterprise marketers, so big brands, are much more sophisticated about digital than they were before. And so what that means is that the solutions they're looking for are also much more sophisticated. A lot of the solutions that have been built in ad tech over time didn't have that same sophistication. And so we're seeing the need to be able to bring together multiple companies to solve problems rather than all problems being solved by one company. So we're very keen on helping or speaking to a marketer with a marketing problem they want to solve, bringing together the different components to have a stack that solves for their needs, and then being able to use that same stack for other like-minded companies. So a good example of that is B2B. B2B marketing is not well supported in the current digital ecosystem. The sales cycle is much longer. The number of people you have to influence, ID graphs are different. A number of things are very different. And so bringing together the right pieces, such as specific data providers, integrations to Salesforce, attribution, et cetera, is critical and is not solved by any one company in the space right now.
Do you think that the cornucopia of ad tech companies helps the market or hurts it?
I'll see. Good.
In the long run, it helps it. In the short run, it hurts it. Right? So the short run is that you can make a lot of mistakes when they're picking partners to work with.
Right.
They have the right solution or the right financial structure, whatever it might be. But in the long run, it drives innovation. And so as these companies innovate, a small company can often innovate much faster than a big company. So having a lot of smaller companies, I think, drives innovation. So long term, I think it's good. Short term, again, it's confusing and people can get stuck in places that they didn't anticipate getting stuck in.
Speaking of innovation, the AI revolution has been heralded as the next frontier. From your vantage point, Jeff, how are you separating the gold rush from the ghost towns when it comes to AI's real impact on advertising effectiveness and investments?
I think we're at the beginning, right? So tip of the iceberg. AI is going to provide so many important opportunities, even just if we're looking at efficiency, right? So I think it's well known that a lot of work in ad tech gets done in other countries, that where labor is less expensive to be able to support a lot of the work that's done in ad tech. And I think a lot of that can be eliminated by using AI. So I think we're just starting to learn how to apply it. Obviously, there are concerns, and rightfully so. But I think there's tremendous opportunity, and we're just starting to see it.
How do you sift through the frenzy to find the real innovators, though? Are you finding Nemo, or are there just a lot of fishy tales?
Well, I think it's about how the business model is going to have an advantage because of AI. It's
right.
Not just the use of AI. I think that's where things get a little bit frothy everywhere, but especially in this space. When something new comes along, CTV, retail media, AI, everybody starts talking about it and everybody has a solution. But what really matters is how is AI going to affect your business? How are you going to be able to use it to provide more value to your customers and to be, efficient and effective as a business?
AI is pushing the boundaries sometimes a little too eagerly. In this era of hyper-aware privacy concerns, how are these red flags shaping your investment compass?
Well, I think privacy is not something new. I often think of privacy as really not about the law, though obviously that's important. It's about respect, right? So how are you respecting the consumer? And I think that's even should be more at the heart of our decision-making about any of the technologies we use, above and beyond what the law is what is the effect on the consumer, and are we respecting the right to make choices and for privacy? So I think that lens on anything we do is super important.
As the money man, how are you advising your portfolio companies to navigate the minefield?
I think it's just going back to what I said, is how do we make sure that what you're doing in AI is going to truly be additive and not just be a marketing tagline?
So peering into the digital beyond, what's the future of AI?
Well, I think that I believe being able to have marketers verbalize what they're looking for and have that work through workflow that helps find solutions by looking at how other opportunities are performing and things like that. I think there's a lot of magic in there.
TV and OTT are the new kids on the block, but as we know, not every new kid turns into a neighborhood favorite. Jeff, how are you assessing this landscape, and what is your master plan for ensuring Aperium doesn't just end up being the nice house everyone waves at but never visits?
Well, look, anytime you're able to use sight, sound, and motion to convey a message, you have something that's going to work very well for marketers. But we also know that an inundation of messaging like that is going to take up a lot of time and eventually be locked. We've seen that in TV advertising, and we know that how a pod is constructed and managed is super important to provide value to the advertiser. So I think that there are a lot of areas in CTV that have room for growth, and it all comes back to how is a consumer going to respond to messages. Obviously, when we're looking at the quality of inventory, I think we're going to see that also experience a roller coaster. We've seen in other formats. There's a rush to CTV. So our publisher is providing truly good video content that an advertiser would want to be in, and a lot of things are going to do that. So we're always taking a look at how realistic the growth view is going to be in CTV.
Speaking of CTV, obviously, audience fragmentation is probably one of the biggest issues. Where do you spot the opportunities to piece together a new picture of success?
Well, one of the things that's happened with audiences is that in an effort to drive scale, I think a lot of companies have rushed to bring scalable solutions that are not really as effective as they could be. So there needs to be a way to do more granular targeting of groups of people and build scale through having many campaigns running rather than one campaign against people that don't really fit the right profile for a campaign.
There's been lots of reports, as you've probably read, about how CTV has enormous amount of fraud, and this is definitely the bane of the ad world. Are you playing whack-a-mole, or do you have some digital Excalibur to slay these dragons for your portfolio companies?
We haven't spent a lot of time on the fraud side of that. I do think that it's going to become more and more important. And you know what we know from the digital world for so long is that there will always be people who can find ways to get around what we put in place. So it's going to be a constant challenge, and I'm hopeful that some of the larger companies that deal in fraud prevention are going to be able to keep up with the needs there.
Do you see this as a Baywatch slow motion run to success or more of a deadliest catch situation?
Probably a combination of both. I like the running part, but the connotation that came up in my head at Baywatch was pretty. You know, we're seeing people move very fast, and fast often breaks things, but if you don't move fast, you're going to get left behind, and then what you're bringing to the table may never be seen. So I think it's a combination of both.
Have you seen any ads like on Netflix that made you think, well, aren't we the clever ones?
Nothing comes to mind. I more look for ad pods
that
are poorly constructed, not so much on Netflix, but on some of the other streaming channels.
What untapped potential are you betting on, and how is Aperium gearing up to plant its flag on this new territory?
Well, look, obviously, retail media is super important, not just because it's a trend, but because it makes phenomenal sense. I personally believe that first-party data will drive more commerce opportunities than less. That said, there's a lot of fragmentation also going on. So how are marketers going to be able to be efficient? But even more so, I think we're just at the beginning of it. Most of the solution for retail media are taking standard routes, which would be, you know, display advertising, CTV advertising, maybe audio. What we're going to end up seeing is a much more immersive experience for the consumer, which includes their mobile device, digital app home, digital shelf space, all of those kinds of things to create a holistic experience for the consumer that is beneficial to the consumer and certainly works well for a marketer because they know the person based on their data, and for the retailer because they're the ones providing the channel for distribution.
In the shadowy corners of ad tech universe, where ad fraud lurks like a thief in the night and transparency is the torch we're all supposed to carry, how is Aperium leading the vigilante squad? Are you donning the superhero cape or lighting the way with a lantern?
Well, I'd love to have X-ray vision and really be able to see what is going on everywhere. Obviously, we can't do that. I think transparency is long overdue. One of the difficulties in transparency is that sometimes it does take someone who's not tech-oriented, understanding things that they may not understand. So transparency, critical, and we do many things to try to drive that. We're very supportive of the ENA and the work they're doing on transparency, helping in a lot of ways to build the enterprise supply chains that feature transparency. And I think there's also a lot of work to do because of the education necessary. But how could it not make sense for a marketer to know what's happening to their dollar when they spend it? Of course, they need to know that. And we should not be hesitant to discuss that. If we are hesitant, then there's probably a problem somewhere. So full believers and fully supportive across the board.
What's the spiciest take that you have that might ruffle some digital feathers?
I just think that companies that are doing really well get a bit sneaky. I mean, obviously, we see it in Google, and I'm not even going to go there. I'll use a long ago example, and I won't refer to any current companies, but Yahoo was one, right? So they were killing it, and they got very uppity. They wouldn't talk to people if they didn't feel like it. It was very hard to get a hold of anyone.
I think of the initials MM for some reason.
So the I think that creates a negative energy toward your company.
Right.
And I mean that in terms of why create people, the opportunity for people to not want to do business with you. As good as you are, eventually you're going to need those people. So why create that in the first place? And I think the companies are doing that now in the space.
So who is your future self high-fiving? I mean, if you could quantum leap forward, who is the big cheese you're hoping to see in the mirror?
I'm looking at him on my camera right now. Not you, me.
Morning rituals. What incantations do you recite to summon the power for another day in the digital trenches? Is it a coffee spell or more of a yoga chant?
It's a bit of a combination. I have a gym in my house, and it's littered with motivational coasters. And anytime I need a little bit of a spice, I go down there and I just look at the coasters and say to myself, why the heck do you have this on the wall if you're not going to pay attention? And it gets me going.
Do you have a hanging cat?
No hanging cats. No cats allowed in the house.
Are there any specific books that transformed you, which tomes rewrote the Jeff Hirsch algorithm? Were they more How to Rule the World or Ad Tech for Dummies?
It was more How to Rule the World. I get a lot of benefit from reading business people's biographies. And Richard Branson, Ted Turner, things like that really are inspirational to me.
Is there one that's like your favorite one?
I'd say the Richard Branson story, just the risk that he took to become successful, but also personally the risk he took to enjoy his life. Pretty phenomenal. When people are betting everything they have on an idea and it works, it's very inspirational.
And how did you apply that to your life?
I've been on things the whole time. When we started going into digital in the first place, starting FastClick after the stint at ValueClick, taking a bet on data in digital, being able to help the transition of SSPs into the software companies they are today, and now at Appure, being able to be involved in many different types of companies and help assess the risk and do make the right moves.
So what's the end game? In the chess match of life and business, what's your next move?
Well, personally, I think work is my hobby, so I don't anticipate ever not working. I'm hoping that at some point I'm on a few boards, stay involved, but no longer have the day-to-day, although I'm not sure what I'll do with my time.
And last, I always ask people, if you could send yourself a time-traveling text message when you first started in the industry, what is one piece of advice you give yourself?
Buy Apple stock.
One says that.
And there you have it, folks. We've reached the end of this wild ride on the Adatat Show. Big thanks and confetti cannons to Jeff Hirsch for parachuting into the ad tech jungle with us, swinging through the vines and bringing back a treasure trove of know-how. From the early days of slinging clicks to pioneering the data-driven revolution, Jeff's journey is a masterclass in navigating the digital frontier. We also can't sign off without a massive thank you to our sponsor, Troutman Amin LLP. Seriously, without their support, we'd just be here talking to ourselves, which, while amusing, probably wouldn't be as informative. Remember, in the ever-evolving world of ad tech, there's always something new to learn, some dragon to slay, or some treasure to discover. And as always, keep your click finger ready and your privacy settings tighter than a drum. This is Pesach Latin, signing off. Until next time, stay curious, stay bold, and no more than you did yesterday.